From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, coming to you from 1540 WADK Newport. I'll talk on all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business, along with the business of politics and sports. A thriller, how the U.S., then the world's sole industrialized power lacking a central banking system, created against the odds the Federal Reserve System. Today on Business Talk with Jim Campbell, Roger Lowenstein's former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he's got books including Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist, When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of Long-Term Capital Management, a firm that was actually based right here in Greenwich, where we're taping this, and The End of Wall Street, for which he was on this show on a prior occasion. He's got latest work, America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. And welcome back, Roger. I guess you've done the impossible. You've made the Fed look interesting.
Pleasure to be on the show. And, you know, I think I was given an assist in that task because the Fed is so much in the news today, and a lot of the battles that they had back 100 years ago when it was being founded, will remind you and your listeners, I think, very much of what's going on today.
Very interesting. And, in fact, the book's been endorsed by Paul Volcker, who's my hero for Fed chiefs, Ben Bernanke, Robert Rubin. So it's a pretty impressive crew. Now, tell us why you wrote it. And this was, of course, stabilizing what was then a chaotic financial system. And just like today, a lot of distrust between bankers and bankers and Main Street, D.C. and bankers. Is there a lesson here in the current dysfunctionality as to why you wrote it?
Yeah, you know, after the mortgage crisis, and you mentioned the book, The End of Wall Street, I'd written about that, that came out in 2010, the Fed was such a big player in certainly rescuing the system and also a big player, you know, we should say, in not having seen the crisis coming, right, that my editor and I, as we were casting about for my next topic, thought it would be very interesting to look at what the country was like before we had a Fed. How did it manage or not manage? And, you know, how do we come to get one? And what I discovered, and, you know, this doesn't seem as foreign as it might in a world today, Ted Cruz, that he wants to get rid of the Fed, and Rand Paul has been saying that for years. People in America had a deep-seated fear of any sort of government involvement in banking, any kind of national bank. And this didn't start 100 years ago. It started in 1791, in George Washington's time, when Alexander Hamilton first proposed a national bank. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson, who was a laissez-faire guy and a small government guy, didn't want any part of it. And we had a bank for 20 years, and because there was such a popular and populist mistrust of a big bank, and people felt it was serving the elites and not the common man and so on, they got rid of it. We quickly had a terrible problem in President Madison's administration. There was a terrible inflation and no good currency without a national bank. So they formed the second bank in the United States. And then we went through the whole thing once more. And, of course, this time it was Andrew Jackson in the 1830s who treated the second bank as a bogeyman, although it really did a very good job in rationalizing the country's finances, getting its debts in order and so on. Nonetheless, Jackson, his followers, didn't want any part of it. And for the next 75 years or so, the United States had no lender of last resort and really a very chaotic organization or misorganization of its finances.
In fact, just sort of rebuttal to that, it's hard to conceive of us being the global leader we are now without the Fed and surviving 08 without the Fed. But I'm going to ask you, let's go back. The situation light exactly before the Fed, around the panic of 1907, and I think in the book you say that really there were like 25 financial panics in the time that the UK with the Bank of England had zero. So explain what was going on. What was that chaos all about?
Yes, 25 minor panics and 6 or 7 major ones or depressions. Jim, if you think of a central bank, it's where the banking reserves of the country are kept. Before there was a central bank, each bank kept its own reserves. I mean, literally in the vault, or might deposit some with a bigger bank. You're in Greenwich. The bank in Greenwich might put some of its reserves with a bank in Stamford, and the bank in Stamford might have loaned them to a bank in New York, where the interest rates are higher. But whenever there was trouble, the bank in Greenwich said to Stamford, "Hey, give me my money back." And so did the bank in Stamford to New York, and the whole system could buckle up and actually freeze. And this is rather incredible, but every fall, when farmers needed cash to harvest the crops in the countryside, pay the field hands, run the equipment, rent the grainage warehouses and so on, cash would drain out of the cities into the countryside, and interest rates would shoot up in the cities. Sometimes they'd go temporarily to as much as 100% because there was no central reservoir of credit to even out these fluctuations. One of the heroes of the book, Paul Warburg, said the banking system resembled a town in which every home had a pail of water, but there was no central reservoir. And that obviously wouldn't be very effective at putting out a fire. Particularly in 1907, we had a major financial fire, so to speak. There were runs on banks across the country, and there was no one in Washington who had the tools or the charter to do anything about it.
A lot of bank runs, basically. Now, the fact that we're going agrarian to industrial, is that sort of like what we're going through now, industrial to information?
Each period, I think, feels like it's going through a unique change, and we wonder if, say, we have a recession, is it cyclical, or are we moving away and the old rules don't matter? But some things do matter, that whether the bank run, as in 1907, say, was a real bank run, as I describe in the book, with people running down the sidewalk to the doors of the local banks to pull out their cash, or whether it was in the form that it took in 2008 in our own lifetimes when we saw this bank run on the screen with green lines turning to red and so on, the electronic panic. Society doesn't survive without credit, and someone's got to be a backstop for that credit. Otherwise, it's going to be susceptible to tremendous runs and to the herd effect and destabilizing panics. And that's true whether we're in 1907 or 2007 and whatever the electronic system they have in 2107. There'll be some system whereby if there's not a backstop, the human herd will get carried away and they'll be sorry for it.
And at this time, we actually had multiple currencies, right? Multiple mediums of exchange.
Well, we had, this time, you mean the early 1900s, 1910 and so on. Yes, we had seven different forms of exchange, various treasury notes, gold certificates, silver certificates, the old greenbacks issued during the Civil War. It was really a monetary polyglot, and we had no central clearinghouse. I tell the story in the book of a grocer in the eastern end of Long Island, New York, who made a purchase via check from a wholesale merchant in Hoboken, New Jersey, just on the other side of the Hudson River. And the check was deposited in his bank in New Jersey. That bank didn't have a correspondent in Long Island, so he sent it up to a bank in Boston, actually. That bank didn't know what to do with it, so they shuffled it over to a bank up near the Canadian border, near Niagara Falls. After that, the bank took a trip back to Albany in New York, made something like nine trips before it finally got sent back to its place of origin. It was it was as if the banks of the country, and one of the founders said this, one of the crusaders who worked for the Fed, it was as if the banks were a group of individual soldiers, each of them marching off on their own with no general staff or commanding staff. And that wouldn't be a very effective way to run an army.
All right. One of the things that makes the book so good is, and there's always the age old, do individuals make history or do events create history with individuals coming up? But you've got four guys who are here at the core, and then a couple of others I want to mention. Let's just kind of go through them. The first one, J.P. Morgan. Was he almost the de facto Fed?
Yeah, J.P. Morgan was, that's a very good way of putting it, the de facto Fed. In 1907, when banks started to tumble, he called together a group of the biggest bankers in New York and organized a series of loans that were distributed amongst the banks that still had capital. They made decisions about which banks were worth saving, which ones weren't, very much playing the role of that we saw Ben Bernanke play 100 years later. However, Morgan's capital and the capital of the banks that he could recruit was limited, and his efforts weren't enough. More than half of the cities, with populations above 25,000, had to limit withdrawals. In other words, depositors could only take out $10 a day or a certain amount a week, or some were shut down entirely. Banks began printing homemade script instead of money. The system really broke down despite Morgan's efforts. And what became clear, by the way, at that time he was nearing 70, So his efforts almost demonstrated to people that if we're really relying on one 70-year-old financier, no matter how earnest and heroic his efforts were, as we move into the 20th century, the U.S. now had the world's largest economy. You just can't do that anymore. We were too big and too involved to rely on the efforts of a lone ranger.
And we'll be right back with the four men at the core and the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. This is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, over 300 stations on the Biz Talk Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Robert Reese, and if you'd like to learn from the top CEOs in America, join me weekday afternoons at 5 p.m. for the Best of the CEO Forum on 1540 AM WADK, Newport, Rhode Island.
And we're back talking with Roger Lowenstein, former Wall Street Journal reporter who's written a seminal book on the making of the Fed. And let's go through some more of these four core guys, and then we'll get into the actual sausage-making. Paul Warburg.
Paul Warburg is really one of the heroes of the book. He was a German financier born to a German banking family. In the late 19th century, he fell in love with an American girl who was the daughter of an American banking family, the Kuhn-Loeb family, in New York. Warburg came to America, and he was astonished at the difference between banking in Europe, where he'd grown up and been educated and trained, and in America. And specifically, he saw this aspect that we talked about earlier of how in America there was no central reserve. Each bank kept its own reserve, and whenever there was trouble, every bank did the thing that was in its own self-protective interest. That is to say, it called in its loans, but of course had the effect of making the condition worse for the community at large, that is to say, accentuating the panic. And he just felt that the American system was holding it back, not becoming of a country that otherwise was becoming an industrial power and a world leader. And quite soon after he arrived in this country, he wrote a paper in which he laid out his arguments for why America should adopt a central bank like the ones that existed in Germany and elsewhere in Europe. And he showed it to his brother-in-law, Kuhn-Loeb, Jacob Schiff, also a very famous financier. Schiff had also emigrated to the U.S., but had been in the country several decades and was very familiar with Americans' antipathy towards central banking. Schiff read the paper and said, Paul, you can't show this to anybody. It's going to get you in trouble. Americans don't want to hear about a central bank. It's not the way to start your career. But just as a teaching experiment, Schiff decided to show the paper to James Stillman, who ran National City Bank, the forerunner of Citibank, and then the biggest bank in the country, to see what he said. And Warburg was at his desk a few days later, and Stillman comes wandering by and mockingly says to him, "How is the great international financier?" And then he says, "Warburg, don't you think the Citibank is doing rather well?" And Warburg hesitated to answer, knowing how powerful Stillman was, but gathered his courage and said, "When the next panic comes, you'll wish your responsibilities were smaller." Stillman walks off in a huff, shaking his head. However, 4 years later, in fact, when the next panic did come, National City Bank and Stillman were thrust into a leading role by J.P. Morgan as one of the banks that had to help try to bail out the others. In the middle of the panic, Stillman comes back to Warburg, finds the banker once again at his desk, and says, "Warburg, where is your paper?"
And unfortunately, Warburg doesn't end up getting a lot of credit when the sausage ends up getting built. How about this Gilded Age legislator, Senator Nelson Aldrich, which I always thought that was Rockefeller's first two names, right? But he didn't grow up rich, this guy.
No, Nelson Aldrich was a grocer born in the little town of Foster, Rhode Island. He was an ambitious business person. He began to go on local boards and so on, eventually was elected to local office. And in those days, the Senate, senators were chosen by the state legislators, And because Aldrich was a friend of local business people, well-known to politicos and so on, at a very young age, he was lifted into the U.S. Senate. This is in the 1870s. By the time of our story, in the early 1900s, he was really one of the most powerful senators, probably the most powerful senator. In fact, the newspapers used to refer to him as the general manager of the United States, a sort of Lyndon Johnson-like figure who could muscle the other senators into going his way. He was very much a friend of business, very much a creature of the establishment, didn't want anything to do with banking reform. But when the panic of 07 came, Warburg sought him out, and Aldrich couldn't help but be impressed by the severity of the problem, and he began to be curious about, you know, maybe we have to fix something, or maybe our system isn't so perfect. And he was curious enough that he led a congressional delegation to Europe the next year, where they spent many, many weeks interviewing bankers, central bankers, and all of the big nations, the big financial nations of Europe. And he came back a changed man. He sought out Warburg, who by then had grown discouraged about what the American public would accept. And he said, Warburg, I like your ideas. I have only one fault with them. And Warburg said, what's the fault? And Aldrich said, you say we cannot have a central bank, and I say we can.
Fascinating. Now, this guy's the chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, Carter Glass, and that's name more famous probably for Glass-Steagall, right?
That's right. Yeah. Can I tell one more bit about Aldrich?
Sure, go ahead.
So Aldrich decides he wants this central bank. He wants this thing that Warburg has been writing about and making speeches about and so on. But they both recognize that the public will absolutely not accept it. So when Aldrich decides to write a bill, actual legislation, he calls in three bankers to help him draft it, including Warburg, only he doesn't invite them to his office in Washington or to his home in Rhode Island. And this is the point, by the way, where the book seems to have been hijacked by a Hollywood scriptwriter, but it's actually true. Aldrich invites them to his private rail car in a rail siding near New York City. They get on. They're all in a sort of disguise as though they're going on a duck hunting trip. Warburg actually has a hunting rifle with him, although he doesn't know the first thing about hunting. They go down to Georgia and take a launch over to Jekyll Island, where there's a very exclusive club at which J.P. Morgan, who you mentioned, is a member. Morgan, in advance, has cleared out the club. There's nobody but these bankers, the Senator Aldrich, and the staff. Even in front of the staff, they don't use their real names. They use aliases. And completely undercover, they write what, in effect, becomes the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act.
And you know, the funny thing is that's sort of like the wise men. That couldn't happen today, right? I mean, you couldn't take, you know, the elitist out and hide them somewhere and write the bill.
You know, it's hard to imagine. Bankers these days all have, retinues of handlers and public relations guys and, you know, soda senators. And of course, the funny thing was that, you know, they were very well intentioned, but by doing this conspiracy, they sort of played out the fears of the worst anti-banking conspiracy alive. And then when this thing became public years later, you know, people said, "See, this whole thing was a plot against the American people." It wasn't a plot against the American people. They were just afraid of that if anyone knew they were writing a bill for a central bank, it would be rejected.
Let's finish this segment. We've got about a minute to go with Carter Glass.
Carter Glass. Probably known to your listeners better by Glass-Steagall, a later bill that he co-authored during the Depression. But he was in the early 1900s, he was a Virginia congressman. He was a Democrat. There's no other way to say this. He was an outright racist, as Virginia Democrats in office were in that day and age. He was very opposed to central or federal power for those sorts of reasons. His father had been a Confederate soldier. He wanted nothing to do with a central bank or a central anything. But he was recruited by Woodrow Wilson to come up with a bill because Wilson knew we needed a central bank, and Carter Glass had to find a way to write a reform that wouldn't violate all of the anti-centralization premises of the Democratic Party.
You're listening to Business Talk with Jim Campbell over the Biz Talk Radio Network. Coming next, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. More with Roger Lowenstein. We're back with Roger Lowenstein, author of America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. Finishing off the four men at the core was President Woodrow Wilson. And first, I was stunned the way you described him because he sounded more like LBJ than the kind of sort of pedantic professor you hear him as. So finish off with Mr. Glass and President Wilson.
Yeah, and Jim, I'm glad you made that point about Wilson, because I think the Wilson that has largely survived in history is the tired old man at the end of World War II, of course, who campaigned in favor of the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations that the American public and the Senate at least refused to embrace and faded away unhappy and defeated. But the Wilson who was elected in 1912 had taken the country by storm. He'd been a university president, governor of New Jersey. He was at once an idealist and very pragmatic and rather cunning in the political arts. He really electrified the country. And when he also knew something about history and about American history and central banking history. He'd given lectures about Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and the early experiments in the National Bank. And he'd written that, you know, he'd very much come down on the side of Alexander Hamilton. It said, you know, it was for purposes like this that the federal government was formed. When Carter Glass, this Southern Democrat, and they were both Southerners. Wilson, of course, was also from Virginia. But Wilson had a much broader outlook. When Carter Glass brought him the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act, there was nothing federal about it at all. Carter Glass proposed that the U.S. set up 20 reserve stations around the country with no tie at all. Just the Rocky Mountain states would have a little central repository. There'd be one in New England, one here, one there. You wouldn't have that strength of collective security by centralizing the reserves in one reservoir that Warburg had lobbied for.
I was really impressed, too, that putting all this together, that Wilson was involved in establishing the progressive income tax, direct election of senators, big tariff reduction bill, the Clayton Antitrust Act, and the Fed. That's a pretty impressive legacy, not counting the League of Nations.
I think all that happened in his first term. And the Federal Reserve Act is generally considered the highlight of his first term, but those were all very big strokes. You name them. The first peacetime income tax, and the first income tax that endured, an end to these terrible tariffs that had been a burden on export trade in the United States and import trade, and, of course, the Clayton Antitrust Act, which put more teeth into the Sherman Act and the Federal Reserve itself. It was a remarkable progressive agenda, and all in his first term. It's one of the easily one of the most accomplished single terms of any president in history. But as you say, it became overshadowed. He ran for office pledging to keep us out of war. Several months later, in 1917, we're at war. And that earlier Woodrow Wilson has, I think, unfortunately, been largely overlooked.
One other person I want to mention, because we're in this era of the Tea Party in here where any kind of compromise is considered the worst thing known to man. I was surprised to hear that Williams Jennings Bryan, right, who was a complete populist, actually ended up supporting this kind of a centralized banking phenomenon.
Yeah, William Jennings Bryan, I went into the book, not with a very high opinion of him. He shot from the hip. He hated bankers. He hated the East Coasters and so on, Easterners. He caused a whole lot of trouble for Wilson when he was running for president because Wilson needed Bryan's support. Although Bryan had run three times for president himself and lost, he was still the most popular among Democrats. Wilson couldn't get the nomination without him. And Bryan insisted that Wilson come out against the central bank as the price for his support. And Wilson pretty much did so. He politics wasn't any different then than now. And one of the bankers said to Wilson, "Why'd you say that?" He said, "Well, I've got to first be elected, or it doesn't matter what I think." And once he got in office, Wilson proposed, or Glass proposed, this bill that he and Wilson worked on and modified and so on and sent to the Congress. It had one element that William Jennings Bryan really didn't like, and that was under the Glass bill, some of the members of the Federal Reserve Board were going to be picked by the banking industry and be bankers. And Bryan said, no, they all have to be public servants, all have to be named by Wilson, all have to be responsible to the political process and to the people. He threatened to resign. He was Wilson's Secretary of State. Had he resigned, he really would have brought down the administration. He certainly would have brought down the Federal Reserve Act. Wilson was really in a pickle, and he called a very famous advisor, later famous advisor of his, Louis Brandeis, and said, "What do I do?" And Brandeis said, you're not in a pickle because Brian's right. These people are going to be supervising the financial system of the country. They should be public servants. And Wilson made the switch. And at that point, Brian also switched and loyally supported Wilson against all kinds of radical populist opposition from within the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives. And without Brian, I doubt he could have gotten the bill passed.
Okay, let's go back to where we were starting. We had multiple currencies, runs on banks. What emerged in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913?
There were a couple of compromises. I'll point out two of them. One was there was this great debate then about whether the central bank should be run by the private sector or the public sector. And remember, back in 1913, we didn't have all these public agencies directing or supervising private industry. So that was a very radical idea. And they compromised. They said the Federal Reserve Board in Washington would, of course, be public. But the individual reserve banks, then and now, they're essentially private. They pay, you know, they're run by private banks in their districts. They pay dividends to those banks and so on. So it's a mixed system. And the other great compromise was this debate about whether control should be central or regional. And obviously they came up with a compromise that I think was really modeled on the compromise in the American Constitution itself. We'd have a hub in Washington and around it on the periphery local regional banks representing people in the various localities. And I was so impressed with their ability to cut through these differences. The conflicts they had then were just as serious. Bankers disagreed with farmers. Wall Street bankers disagreed with country bankers. Republicans disagreed with Democrats. People in the Northeast didn't see it the way people in the interior of the country did. But they were able to come up with a solution that was enduring and salutary, that really pleased most sides, even at that time. And, you know, Jim, when I look today at the political system, I wonder if we still have that ability to tackle a very tough problem, a complicated problem, and work through to a workable solution. And I think what happened in 1913, I'd like to think it could be a model.
They did reject fiat money and deposit guarantees, which is kind of interesting, right, since we're with both of those now.
These ideas were around in 1913, or I should say the idea of deposit insurance. It was considered very radical for the same reasons that occasionally causes problems today. People feared that if the government insured deposits, bankers wouldn't be as careful with where they lent out their money, there'd be what we call a moral hazard. Various states adopted deposit insurance after the Panic of 1907, and the state systems eventually all failed. And it wasn't until, obviously, the Depression and the Glass-Steagall Act when the country adopted deposit insurance. It did make it into versions of the Federal Reserve Act, but only on the Senate side, not on the House side. And I think it was one of these ideas that had to be studied, debated, thought about what's the best way to do it. It was too radical to be adopted at that time. Fiat money was something altogether different. Virtually nobody then supported fiat money. Even William Jennings Bryan wanted money backed by silver, not money backed by nothing. And I think, you know, I talk in the epilogue, if the founders came back, what would they think of things today? It's clear that they would have been shocked that we would have a system where the money was merely based on confidence. That was, just not something that the 19th century mind did accept or would accept. And you know, that happened in stages in the U.S., again, in the 1930s, partially, and then Richard Nixon, of course, cut the tie to the gold standard completely in 1971.
Maybe we should have stayed with not fiat money.
Well, you know, the gold standard, it worked fine if you were a banker on Wall Street, but it caused tremendous hardship throughout the country. We get very excited here at the mere whiff of a possibility of deflation. We had deflation in the United States in the late 1860s through to 1896, 30 years in a row. The price of wheat had fallen by two-thirds. Yeah. You think if you're a farmer out in Kansas or someplace, and the price of your product falls year after year after year, and meanwhile you've got a debt that you know whose value doesn't change. You're trying to pay off a fixed debt by selling a commodity that sells for less year after year after year. You know, even Milton Friedman looked at it and said the system just didn't work. The constraint, you know, constraining the money supply to the level of metal that was extracted out of the ground just didn't work as the economy grew and became more complicated and more sophisticated.
We're going to be back with Roger in just a few minutes. We're going to look at some issues that the Fed still faces even today. And we're back with our final national segment with Roger Lowenstein about his new book on the creation of the Federal Reserve. We're going to jump till today because there are a lot of similar issues that have traveled through time with the Fed. And you know, some will say the Fed is the only government institution because it's independent that can make the tough decisions, whether it's allowing a lot of banks to shut during the Depression, Paul Volcker taming inflation, or in 2008 when really the Fed saved the global economy. And I'm wondering, you know, printing money, we were just talking about fiat money, printing money out of the kazoo and quantitative easing, would the founders have been stunned?
In every one of the particulars, they would have been stunned. This huge building, or two buildings, you know, face-to-face, you know, near Georgetown, you know, hundreds of economists pouring in and out of the buildings every day, seen as so central to the ordinary economic lives of ordinary Americans. The various tools that they have, such as quantitative easing, they wouldn't have anticipated any of that. However, if they took a bird's-eye view and said the United States had a financial panic and there was an institution that came in to lend when everyone else was refusing to lend, that the central bank came in and, as the saying is, they leaned into the wind when everyone else was running away, I do think they would have said that was the purpose that we created this institution for, to be a lender of last resort. So in that very broad sense, I think they would have been gratified.
Has, in a sense, there been the mission creep in the direction of the monetary policy? The Fed is almost substituted for fiscal policy due to gridlock. And I want to get your opinion on the new sort of institutions that have been created they control, like SIFI, FISOC, Consumer Finance Board, et cetera.
There has definitely been mission creep. And, you know, there was fear of mission creep when the bill was being legislated. Some of the more populist congressmen and senators said this thing is of a nature whose power is only going to grow over time. The specific mission creep that that you talk about, because there was gridlock in Congress, you know, Bernanke has admitted that, or you know, said in his face, we had to do more because Congress did less. You know, to my mind, no one's refuted Keynesian stimulus, and the Congress just, you know, after a very brief flirtation with it in 2009, refused to do it. And so the Fed felt it was the only game in town. You know, I think that was regrettable, but I don't think they were wrong. They had the mission, that part of the mission, thrust on them. The other part of the mission creep wasn't so much creep as it was legislated in the Humphrey Hawkins Act in the late 70s when the Fed was created. Implicitly, its purpose was only to protect a stable currency and to be a lender of last resort. Congress, in the Humphrey Hawkins Act, added another purpose, which was, besides maintaining the value of the dollar, to maximize employment or growth. And so that wasn't a creep so much as it was a change motivated by the very hard times of the 1970s, where they said, you know, we don't want the kind of Fed we had in the 1930s, where they didn't help us during the Depression or weren't effective during the Depression. We want an active Fed that will be active on both sides.
What would the founders have said about too big to fail?
You know, there are no missionaries in foxholes. Nobody likes too big to fail. Nobody bails out banks because they want to. By the way, Hank Paulson didn't like too big to fail. But when you're in charge of the Treasury of the United States, and there's been a run of banks, and suddenly it feels like if you don't do something, there's going to be a run more failing, theory kind of goes out the window. So, I think you'd have to put them in the foxhole with Hank in September of 2008 and say, Fannie and Freddie have failed, Lehman failed. Do you want AIG to go too? And by the way, there's a run on money market funds now. No one wants a policy too big to fail, but I find it really strange that the backlash against the Fed. If the Fed had done nothing and allowed the recession to get worse and develop into a full-blown depression, I could understand the the complete anger at the Fed.
Yeah.
But the fact that people are angry at the Fed for coming in actively and rescuing the system and preventing things from getting worse, I find that kind of strange.
And that's a great point leading me into, you mentioned at the beginning, this governance issue, this independence issue, and this big bank versus Main Street issues are all the same as they were back in the founders. Is there a threat to their independence, you think, coming? And is the politicization of the Fed one of the most dangerous things that could actually happen?
There's a clear threat to it. There are bills, Rand Paul's bill audit the Fed, and various other bills would either require the Fed to declare a rule by which it would set interest rates and explain any time interest rates didn't heed that rule, or it would put it under the daily, its rate-making decisions, its monetary decisions, under the daily supervision of Congress. I mean, do you really want Elizabeth Warren, Ted Cruz, people of either political extreme, anyone in Congress, they'd be promising in the stump, hey, low interest rates, we promised cheap loans, cheap mortgages. Is that, you don't want to put those kinds of decisions into the hands of elected officials. You said your hero was Paul Volcker, and he's one of my heroes too, and he withstood some really tough criticism. And let's face it, if Paul Volcker had had to run for office, there's no way he could have lifted interest rates up to 19%. You can't do that and be part of the direct political process. So I think these bills would be a terrible mistake.
Interesting. The book starts off, the Bank of England is sort of a model versus our chaos. Now, in a sense, the Fed has done things much more aggressively and better than the BOE, do you think? And do you think in some senses the Fed has more power than the presidency?
The Washington Post wrote an editorial way back in 1913, just around the time that the bill was enacted, saying that this organization that's being created will, in some sense, have more power than the presidency. I don't think so, for the reason that, as powerful as the Fed is, it can only create the conditions. It can't, it can't invent the software that allows a Google or, all these Uber and all these other companies to crop up. Or it can't decide what to do if there's competition in manufacturing. Are we going to withstand the competition? Are we going to move our factories offshore? All of the millions of economic decisions that American workers, investors, business people make every day, those are all up to us. And to expect that the Fed, it can create conditions, it can create good conditions, it can create poor conditions. To think of it as the Wizard of Oz behind the screen that can just magically create prosperity or magically lift the rate of growth, it can't do that. And one of the PR problems of the Fed is people have come to think too much of it or expect too much of it.
That's a great way to end it. In fact, maybe saying Congress should do more of their job. I want to say thanks to Roger Lowenstein. It's an important book, but it's also a great read, and it's a great story, amazing story. That book, again, is The America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve. It's published by Penguin Press. I want to thank Roger for coming back again for the second time. We'll see everybody again tomorrow at 1 p.m. for another edition of Business Talk with Jim Campbell right here on Newport's News and Talk Station, 1540 AM WADK, and streaming at WADK.com everywhere.